Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And as we were just wrapping up in talking about this change that the Continental Congress was seeking from the states in allowing them to regulate foreign trade, and foreign trade alone, it created an interesting question by Paul. And so welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
And so I made a comment that when we were talking about, you know, allowing, you know, foreign trade, because I made a comment how California violated the Commerce Clause by keeping Detroit or Michigan vehicles from being able to be sold because they said you have to make them to these standards. They can't dictate to another state how that car is to be manufactured. If you're going to have cars in your state, and then you have to dictate. But here's the other problem. Here's the other rub. California assumed powers over cars and the production of cars when that's not even in their state constitution.
And they assumed powers over cars being made in other states.
Yes, right? They basically told other states that you can't do this. Now, what they should have done, and I said what they should have done is kind of like they should have started producing cars. They should have went to Detroit and or Michigan and where these cars are being manufactured, said, we want you to make a plant here and we want you to make these cars in this way. You know, we're going to bring you here. And this would have been good for California. This would have been good for the production. It would have actually probably been good for the environment, because especially if they were actually making cars better.
Right.
Right? Is not competition better? In other words, you know, when we allow corporations to say, well, this is what we're making, and that's what you're going to get, then that's never good. I mean, you know, that's like the Soviet Union. You know, everybody gets the same flashlight and they're all broken.
Right.
And we all know that there are mass-producing corporations. Mass-producing corporations have this allowable failure rate. You know, you go buy some cheap electronics, and there's a good likelihood that it'll break, or it'll break at an early, you know, point, long before, a lot sooner than you would think it would. And so that's what you get. You're not buying a product based on its quality. I mean, when you like your old transistor radios, or really the tube radios and hi-fi radios, there's different standards, and you get what you pay for. Most people, when they go and buy this cheap crap, that's just disposable income being spent on something that I only, you know, if I get it more than, if I can use it more than once, that's fine. I'm just looking for, you know, using something real quick. And in other words, it's a disposable item. But then there's these things called durable goods. Now, who wants to go out and buy a washing machine that's going to break in a year or two or three?
Right.
Whirlpool used to make, and American manufacturers used to make great things. But we became so disposable, the durable goods and the lifespan of a durable good went down dramatically because we started throwing crap into China, into production.
Right.
Now, I made a comment that, you know, that when bringing foreign manufacturers into America so that they could build to our standards, then that was actually the right thing to do. However, that caused some questions and so forth, which is where you threw that, you know, that pitch at me, and we didn't cover that. So what were you saying?
So here's what's going on. All right. I'm looking at this is Article 1, Section 10. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant, letters of marque, and reprisal. It's treaties, alliance, and confederation that I'm referring to.
Right.
Okay. And so we don't have we've got a lot of things going on. You know, one of the things that the states actually don't have the ability to do is to go to foreign nations and say, hey, you know, make independent agreements with them to bring business or do business. But at the end of this clause says without the consent of Congress.
That's right.
So Congress can consent to foreign business coming to a state. And I think you pointed out, you know, I don't know if recall if it was during the show or briefly after, that they can't own the land, but they can do the business. You know, in other words, it can be done. It's just that Congress needs to consent to that. Correct.
So, yes, but let's back up.
Okay.
Let's go back to the Commerce Clause.
Okay.
So the federal government has the responsibility of regulating commerce from foreign nations coming into America.
Mm-hmm.
So their job is to protect the production in America of certain goods and certain products.
Okay.
Now, if there's such a demand in America for that particular good that, you know, and let's just say Mercedes or Volkswagen and that style and make of a car,
mm-hmm.
then does the federal government, based on the Commerce Clause, have the ability to make a deal with Volkswagen, and then Volkswagen just goes where they, okay, we want to do this in Alabama, and then Alabama is stuck with Volkswagen coming in there and buying up land and basically getting away with doing their processes and so forth? No. Alabama right. is a sovereign state. So in other words, mm-hmm. the federal government doesn't have the power in that Commerce Clause to dictate that these foreign states are going to come in, buy up property, and so forth. As a matter of fact, Alabama cannot allow Volkswagen to own that plant.
Ah.
What okay. has to happen is that becomes a lease agreement. They can never own that property. They can never own the materials and the resources. They can own their intellectual property. And there can, you know, and so one of the things is, you know, obviously when Volkswagen would come in, we would respect their intellectual property so that when they leave the plant, they leave production, let's say they decide to go over to Indiana to start producing
right.
and abandon right. 10 years later their plant in Georgia. Well, Georgia should have baked into their agreement, one, that they would actually make sure that the destruction of intellectual property is overseen by, you know, to respect that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this plant and this property needs to be basically demolition, because when you look at, you know, somebody coming in and doing something and they create this steel industry, this factory or what have you, it has to be disposed of. So you have to kind of bake into the agreement that there's going to be some agreement that they will try to do a certain amount of restoring the property, or at least converting that property into something usable so that it doesn't
right.
become, you know, a huge monstrosity. And I'll give you a good case in point. Look at how many cities build these, you know, entertainment stadiums for their sports teams. And how much, you know, how much does it cost to demolition? I mean, when you look at the cost of a sports arena, and they all of a sudden they say, well, you've got to improve this. And to improve that, it costs just as much money as it would to build a new one.
Right.
Because you've got to go in, you got to do demolition, you got to do all this cleanup, and you got to do it in such a way that you don't destroy the integrity of the current
site.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, it's like sometimes home improvements can be so costly that it might be cheaper just to, you know, build a brand new home.
Right.
So you have to kind of bake all of that stuff in, but the state should actually have the control. They should actually be able to dictate what the standards. Now, 9 times out of 10, when we look at the states. When we look at state labor and so forth, you know, the reason why Volkswagen would go to Alabama is because maybe the average income of the average household is much lower, so that the wages would be lower.
Right.
This is exactly what happened in America in the 1800s as the Rust Belt developed. Manufacturing started migrating from the north to the south, and it created this abandonment. And the people that ended up getting that Rust Belt, they weren't happy because there wasn't anything baked. There was nothing baked into the process or into these contracts to say when these companies abandon this, they have to either demolition this or they have to at least prepare it so that it becomes usable for somebody else.
Which is why we've got all these abandoned factories that are falling apart or whatever they are.
Right. And okay. When we actually... The reason we have such problems is because people want to move on to the next best and greatest thing. And next thing you know, you've got this rubbish and pile. And so when we look at, you know, city, county, and state planners, they don't care about the ramifications of what happens after this, after they create all of this.
In other words, they want to move on, but they haven't baked in how to clean up after.
Right. So in other words, they're really not planners, because a planner should actually have a full cycle, you know, plan.
Right.
It's in other words, it's only, you know, a plan of doing one part of the lifespan of this facility. What about the transition of this facility when it's no longer of use? Because do you really want to, you know, actually change? Because let me ask you this. Who pays for the public services when you have to do all the hookups? Well, 9 times out of 10, the city actually pays to, you know, create those sewage lines and to run those water lines for you, right? And so we've done such a shoddy job in planning, and sometimes we accept marginal because it's all about the bottom line. That look at, we used to build homes with copper pipes, and now now we actually have PEX and some other things. But you know, I can't believe we went to PVC. I can't believe that some of these things, just because it was so much cheaper, that we now have homes that have really questionable materials. How did that? Well, because people wanted to be able to buy a home and move into it. And they didn't realize that when you create plumbing, the cost of redoing your plumbing is almost basically destroying your home and redoing the whole thing. Everybody realizes that that can really add up.
Right.
It would have been better to just have it done right the first time, and it would have been cheaper.
Right.
Anyway, but so my point is that we could have gone down this path of creating these agreements that would have actually respected the sovereignty of the states, allowed the states to be, you know, drivers of respecting, you know, the sovereignty of the counties. But by eliminating the county voice, by eliminating the people's voice of the county and creating democracies, everybody started chasing the short end proposals. You know, what's going to get us the money? You know, just show me the money. Let's make some money. Instead of let's build a society. In other words, we've kind of lost, and this goes down this path of what is enlightenment. Enlightenment is applying discipline, you know, and looking at, you know, the entire picture of, you know, we want to do this. Well, let's look at the full picture of the full lifespan of this facility, what we're doing, and how, you know, how do we plan on integrating this when it served its, once it's fully served its purpose and we want to go to something else.
Right.
Anyway, I don't want to go down that path. I've already gone down, you know, we've spent probably 15 minutes on this rat hole.
Well, It's something that needs to be illustrated, and I'm grateful that you brought that up. I hadn't even thought of that, but planners should consider the entire life cycle of something. They put together.
And that should be our expectation of government. Government, because government is, you know, employing these planners.
Right.
And so, you know, they're employing strategies that are actually destroying our liberty and taking away our property rights and all these other things. How is this even happening in America today with this Agenda 2030 or, you know, what the World Economic Forum is doing? How is this happening? It's happening because we have given up, or we have let go of the reins of our self-government. We should be demanding our government be far more thoughtful of, you know, the ramifications of everything that they're doing.
Right. And getting back to something else, it's to my original question, I'm grateful that we covered this, because I actually, for a moment, you know, I thought that it actually made me think for a while that businesses, foreign businesses in the United States were prohibited. No, they're not prohibited. It's just that Congress regulates. That's one of its delegated functions. It regulates foreign commerce with the states, right?
Correct, period. And they're supposed to be protecting us, not selling us out. So when Congress allowed China to come in and start buying Smithfields and allowing them to buy and own the majority of all of our pigs, our resources, how is that constitutional? They don't have the power to do that.
Oh, it's not. But the good news is it's not. Business, states doing business with foreign entities isn't unconstitutional. It just requires approval from Congress.
It requires the approval from Congress, not the forcing from Congress. And by the way, states cannot allow, the federal government cannot allow states to sell their resources either. That's not in the Constitution. They don't have the ability. As a matter of fact, the way it's written, because of the enumerations, they cannot, you know, sell anything. It all has to be protected. They, you know, oh, well, the only way we're going to get, you know, this investment is, you know, by selling us out. I'm sorry, we don't have the authority to sell us out. And anyway.
Right.
So okay. This isn't, you know, this, this isn't an elaborate web. The federal government they don't have the authority. If they don't have the authority, they can't do it.
Right.
States don't have the authority, they can't do it. They can allow, but they can't sell their property. It is antithetical to a sovereign state to allow a foreign state to own any resource within their state. They have sovereignty over all things in that state.
Now, okay, let me ask you just one more question, because I'm trying. Let's say I've got a business. Uh-huh. That I want, and I want to do, I want to do business with a foreign entity.
Right.
Okay. My company, and I'm a registered corporation in my state, so I probably should contact my congressman with a plan and say, hey, this is what we need to do constitutionally. Will you help me do this?
So this is a business in a state, though, right?
Yeah, this is a business in a state.
So you should actually contact your state legislature.
Ah.
And they should actually be the ones speaking to Congress, foreign nation, and what have you, right? Because who controls all businesses within the state? If a business is going to operate in a state, it has to go to a very specific body to register to say, we're going to conduct business.
Okay.
What is that body? To conduct business within a state, it is the state legislature, whatever delegated authority, whether that is, you know, the Commerce Department, if they have one, or whatever, right? Does that make sense?
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Great news. Okay, because, you know, I can't tell you. It's just that it's not that I can't do business with a foreign entity. It's just that I have to go through the process.
Right.
The Constitution.
But the whole process has been completely perverted because the federal government has assumed everything.
Right.
And the states have become the administrators of whatever the federal government wants to do. And they can't do these things. They don't, at least the Constitution doesn't delegate that authority to them.
But you said just a little earlier that you told the audience Your state's an independent nation.
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
An independent sovereign nation. That's what we have.
But it's a part of a union where when it goes to external affairs, we have to work through that general government that manages those external interfaces.
Correct.
In other words, they'll manage the external interface with a nation like Germany and then the corporation like Volkswagen. Now, technically, in most of these states like Germany or Japan, those corporations are government subsidized.
Correct.
In other words, they're not really private industries. They're government industries.
Which is another reason that we should follow the process, because it's the job of Congress to protect our business and our nation's interests.
Interest, that's yes. And the same thing with the states and the same thing with the counties. Because guess what? When it comes into a state, it's not just going to be, you know, from one border of the state to the other border of the state. It's going to go into one county or a pair of or a shared counties, right? Let's say it's in a tri-county area. It literally the business sits on the, you know, the cross point of three counties where, you know, it actually is occupying property in three separate counties.
Right.
You know, it might be that intersection or that point. But whatever, those counties are now involved in this.
Right.
And they should actually have some say as to what's happening. Not this populist center that says we want cheap computers, we want cheap cars, and we're going to send it out over to your county, and they're going to pollute, and they're going to do all these bad things over there.
Right.
That's we have a democracy that has basically inflicted all sorts of misery upon us because of a democracy.
Right. Okay.
And there is a cost when you say feed us, feed us, feed us, that, you know, nine times out of ten, as this goes down to what Benjamin Franklin said, when you have a government powerful enough to do anything and everything for you, they have the power to take everything from you.
Right.
Right. And so if we're not supposed to have that kind of government. We're not supposed to have that kind of government. We're supposed to have a self-government where we are governing ourselves. So we've basically taken up the first half of the show talking about commerce and how to and we didn't even get into the real hows and the nuts and bolts, but bottom line, there are a lot of stakeholders, or I should say there are a lot of parties involved who have their own interests because they are actually representing the people of that county. They're representing the people of that state. They're representing the people of the union. They're dealing with people of a foreign state and so forth and so on. And so, you know, if we allow the federal government and a foreign nation to do all the bidding for us, we're screwed.
Right. But the relief for me and the reason this question is particularly important is because I have an opportunity to be involved in two companies that have international interest. I had earlier put in my mind, oh, I can't do that. But the relief is I can do it. It's just there's a constitutional process that protects me, protects my state, and protects my nation. Okay?
Right.
And I'm all for that.
Right. Yeah, and because the states have never done the, you know, have they ever created a law that says that you have to, when you write with ink, you need to use paper or a specific medium or a usable medium, a sustainable medium or anything like that? No, they don't. As a matter of fact, you have the ability and you know the freedom to actually grab a piece of cloth or to grab a napkin and write a formula or something on it. And, you know, we have this ability. But the point is, had they made it a law, then you could only use this kind of paper. You could only use this kind of linen. And that's not the intent of a limited and defined government, nor is it the intent of a self-government. In other words, you know, they never created the laws that they needed to in protecting our sovereignty and are protecting our property, our resources, and the states actually should have done that. But there's sometimes, you know, we don't want the states to actually create laws to the nth degree to where, you know, they're going to dictate, you know, whose casket you use or whose paper and pen you use. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so one of the things that, you know, I think really begs to be added to this conversation is the thought of controlling land and resources, right? So because clearly the state cannot allow foreigners to just come in and buy any piece of property.
Right.
There needs to be, and so I started rambling about, you know, we don't want laws to dictate stupid things, but we have to have laws that really do lay out that the state has a responsibility as the stewards of the state. Our representatives, who are the stewards of our state, have a responsibility to ensure that the state property is protected from parasites, whether it's a parasite, you know, and I'll call it a foreign parasite, that somebody is not a resident of that state like Bill Gates. Mm-hmm. Bill Gates should not be able to come in because he has money and buy up a bunch of property and be able to, you know, move his business there or what have you. They need to make sure that everything that is done is, you know, and this goes down to where in the state constitution, we have to make sure and make it clear that, you know, when the lawmakers allow, you know, a deal or a transaction to occur, that the consequences of those, you know, those actions need to be basically levied upon them. In other words, we have to make it so that when, you know, the state cannot, nor can they ever, allow any foreigner to own, and you have to define what a foreigner is, mm-hmm. right? So what's a foreigner to your state? A resident of another state, even within the union. Even though the Constitution creates this reciprocity of individual privileges and immunities, it doesn't give a person the immunity to be able to conduct warfare from one state against all these other states.
Okay.
We live in a time, and I've said this before, and I think I've said this several different times and ways. We live in a time when the brokers of the world, the holders of the world wealth were nations.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've kind of, you know, when we created this free market, we created the ability for a person, an individual, to amass an amount of wealth, that is equal to, if not greater than, a nation.
Oh, yeah. And some of them have that. And by the way, they used the system we have to abuse the system we have.
I think the word you're meaning to use is exploit.
Yes, exploit, correct.
And so, yes, that's true. Because we don't have measures to protect us. In other words, this goes down to the conversation that I've said that needs to be had. This goes all the way back to Jefferson when Jefferson made the comment, the land belongs to the living. In other words, the state cannot allow somebody to come in and buy up all of this land for a business, for them to function for the interest of international, you know, like a ranch. Somebody comes in and basically buys up all of this, you know, land, and they, you know, put cattle on it, and they sell this cattle through, for the world, at the expense of the state and the people living in that state. And I'll give you a good case in point, specifically on cattle and how this became a real problem, because there's this place called Norco, California.
Okay.
And Norco, and, you know, in this area, Rancho Cucamonga, it's kind of in Riverside County, but this was an area where they had a high concentration of cattle, and that high concentration of cattle was there for so long that when we drove through these areas, I would always call it the pew here. You'd actually, you know, it was very common that there'd be this, you know, ground fog, and it just smelt like cow urine.
Okay.
It was just nasty. And, you know, thank heavens for the advent of circulating air in a car. But my point is this, is that this cattle broker, and this goes back to how planners did not accommodate the plan. And what ended up happening as urban sprawl continued and continued, they started building these housing developments, or because what ended up happening was it just became too expensive to maintain growing, you know, having cattle in this area. So they basically ended up selling the land and they moved out of there.
Okay.
And what they did was they actually, you know, did a little bit of a reclamation, and they allowed a developer to build homes on this land. And before you knew it, I mean, the deals, people were already moving in. I think there were properties that had been unsold in these big developments, and people, you know, had these trees that couldn't grow. In other words, anything with deep roots actually went down and died. You couldn't have a tree on this property because the ammonia level was through the roof.
Right.
And there, so there was all of these other residual problems because of this excessive, you know, urine and so forth, right?
Right.
And so the government failed in making sure that there was a policy and or a plan in place that they would remove all of that. So, in other words, the developer who wanted to make a quick buck just basically did some scraping, brought in some topsoil, and then they put these houses on top of it, and they, you know, tried to get away with making, you know, an obscene amount of money, because that's what they do.
How did that turn out?
Not good. Not good, because the you know, the people that really lost were those people who couldn't afford to lose. It's always that way. The people that can't afford, you know, the lawyer, the cost, or, you know, they can't write that off.
Right.
And you can't write off life. And so we have to have a state government and a state constitution that makes sure that people can't lose that.
Right.
There's, it's almost like, I need to actually pull that ad out there, because there's an ad that talks about title insurance, you know, and title lock. How is it possible that somebody can scam, you know, and forge documents and steal your home and leverage it, and then all of a sudden the bank comes and takes, but forecloses your home? How could that ever be a legitimate and legal process where you can lose, where they could even knock on your door and say you have to move?
And here's what gets me. Someone has made a business out of the fact that people do that, when really this is someplace where the government needs to protect the homeowners. In other words, why should I buy Title Lock? Why should I buy something that protects me, some kind of insurance against, you know, someone stealing my home? What Title Lock really ought to do is alert the county government, hey, someone is trying to do this, and you need to protect the people. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words...
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I don't necessarily agree with, you know, the method, and work with me on this.
Okay.
Because right. when we look at the protection, it should just be this simple, that no mm-hmm. person, no person can lose their property in any way, whether it's a car, whether it's a business, whether it is your house. No person, no entity can lose their property without the clear empirical evidence and data that that person was absolutely and directly involved in the transactions for the loss of property.
Correct.
In other words, you know, when somebody comes, when the bank comes along, before the bank can actually say, hey, I don't know who you are that's living in this house, but you have no right to be here anymore. We're foreclosing on it because, you know, we have this huge debt against this house.
Mm-hmm.
And it's with this person over here. And that person says, well, then go get your money and go get their home because this is my home, and mm-hmm. I'm not involved in that transaction where you claim that you can actually, you know, own this house.
Right.
I mean, it needs to be a very simple, clear-cut law that you cannot lose property unless it is, you know, unless it can be absolutely proven that you were involved in the transactions for the loss of property.
Right.
Which basically it's fraud, you know, it's like creating a fraud law, but it's got to be simple. We can't create these huge, long, you know, where lawyers make money in going through and dissecting the law. I mean, how simple would it be to just pass a law that basically says no person in this state can lose property unless it is proven that they were directly involved in transactions for the loss of that property. In other words, they went to a pawnbroker and they actually leveraged their home for a $100 loan.
Right. Oops.
Yep. Or whatever it is. They you know, it's proven that they went in, you know, into a poker game and they said, I'll bet my house on it. If you can prove that they directly were involved in a transaction, now that poker game may be, in most states, will be illegal.
But understand what you're saying. If that would bring a screeching halt to
banks giving out loans recklessly,
right.
that would create a screeching halt from insurance companies being able to make money, and because really. Does that mean that they guarantee that you won't lose your home? No, they just, hey, we're going to warn you and tip you off and we'll help you. But, you know, when it really comes down to, if it's too much, too expensive, we're not going to spend that much money to help save you. So in other words, the fact that Title Lock and these other companies are out there, they're parasites.
Well, I guess that's what I was trying to say. You know, they're making money off a bad situation, which people actually should be somehow protected, right?
Right. It's like how many states are going to a no-fault insurance. Why is that? Washington State has actually gone to, unconstitutionally, they've basically declared a no-fault insurance because most accidents, they will, and the reason why is the insurance companies want to ensure that both parties have to pay their deductible. In every accident, if it is a at-fault state, then the deductible only comes out of one party. But the beautiful thing about a no-fault is everybody has to pay their deductible every time, and they can start raising your rates as well as theirs because you were involved in an accident.
Isn't that interesting?
So, in other words, it pays the insurance companies to allow these types of laws. So that, well, look, you were involved in three accidents, and you know, we have to raise our rates
because we've got no fault insurance.
There you go.
Wow.
And so they're actually out there. It's like the tire industry actually dictating that you have to change, you know, you cannot drive your car without having this quality of tread on your tires. And so when you go in and you want them to, you know, change out your tire from summer or winter or what have you, they say, well, we can't touch that. You either have to buy new tires or do it yourself. And that empowers them to basically make money. There's a law now in many states that say that you have to do these things. They mandate you to spend money on tires. What they could do is actually, and what we should do is actually transfer the liability. It's the same thing with injuries. You know, when you look at let me finish with the tires.
Okay.
When you go to, you know, get your tires serviced, you want to, you know, put summer tires on and take off your winter tires, and they may be kind of bald. All you do is you sign a liability that if I have an accident, I'm aware of the fact that I'm driving a car with, you know, not the desirable best performing tires. And if I have an accident, then I will be held liable for that accident.
You know, I've had that experience in which I had a, my tire guy, and I went to him regularly, wouldn't put certain tires on because he would be liable.
Right. And all we need to do is sign a release of liability. That's right. All we need is to constantly and basically make it so that business can always be conducted and that a release of liability can always be injected. So in other words, when the car shop says, hey, I can't do that because I'll be liable, they should basically say, but if you sign this release of liability, we'll do it for you.
Sure.
And I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with them actually saying, you know, for a reasonable fee, whatever that is, that they, you know, document and they keep these release of liabilities for people. I'm okay mm-hmm. with that.
Right.
But I'm not okay with them strong-arming you and saying, you need to change these tires. You need to actually throw money at the tire industry because – and then we have to cycle and we go through more tires and we cycle more tires.
Right.
Don't we have a problem with that?
Right. And then we have to dispose of more tires.
There you go. Right. And so the reality is that it's the same thing in the tire industry as it is in – auto injuries.
Okay.
If you're driving a motorcycle or you're driving a car, let's stick with the car because a motorcycle, you're just stupid if you don't wear a helmet.
Okay.
But if you're driving a car and you choose not to wear the seatbelt, the insurance mm-hmm. company should not be accountable for the injuries of your own insurance company or even if you're not at fault.
Right.
You should, if there were safety precautions and safety measures that were available by the technology of that car, and you chose not to use them,
mm-hmm.
then you should not have any right to say you have to pay for my injuries.
Mm.
This would change our insurance system completely. But they want these problems. They want these types of things to happen so that they can make more money. And if we actually started shifting the consequences of our own decisions upon ourselves, but see, the people don't want that. People don't want to be held accountable. It's like when you look at, you know, somebody that gets arrested for graffiti, you know, that a part of the punishment should be that that person actually has to go and restore. Absolutely. You know, they have to pay for the paint. They have to do whatever is necessary for the damage that they did.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and we got 9 minutes to go into this next one. It's a short one, but
okay.
it's like the guy that drives a vehicle into the mountain pass. I've said this on my show before. That if you're driving a vehicle going into the mountain pass in snowy weather and you don't have adequate tires to deal mm-hmm. with the road conditions you're driving into, and you have an accident that basically shuts down the freeway in all directions or what have you, you should have to bear the financial burden of the lost wages and everything of all of the people you just affected.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that would put somebody into bankruptcy. And bottom line, then they would have to, and I believe bringing back bankruptcy courts and bankruptcy, or I should say debtor prison, because I honestly think that we need to come up with a way to say it's not okay to default on, you know, your community,
your obligations,
and those types of things.
Yeah, I think there should be a strong incentive not to for people to be accountable for their actions.
Right. Yes. And I digress. And we've gone down a lot of little rat holes here, but getting into this next amendment that is recommended, which is titled Amendments to Grant Commercial Powers to Congress.
Let me find it.
Okay, so
actually, I should have been ready, but let me find it.
Okay,
I didn't know which one you're going to do.
Yeah, it's the. There's only two more left. This is the second to last, and it's a short one. It's a single paragraph, and this was March
1785.
Amendment to grant commercial powers to Congress, and so. Basically, this is, when we looked at granting the regulation of commerce over, you know, foreign commerce and so forth, we thought that would have involved, you know, within the states or what have you. And no, it didn't. But let's go into this one. You got
okay.
it?
Okay. Yeah, I've got it.
Okay.
Let me expand it. Okay. Amendment to grant commercial powers to Congress. 28 March 1785. The first paragraph of the ninth of the Articles of Confederation be altered so as to read thus, viz., quote, United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive right and power of determining on peace and war, except in the cases mentioned in the sixth article, of sending and receiving ambassadors, entering into treaties and alliances, of regulating the trade of the United States as well with foreign nations as with each other, and of laying such imposts and duties upon imports and exports as may be necessary for the purpose, providing that the citizens of the states shall in no instance be subject to pay higher imposts and duties than those imposed on the subject of foreign powers. Provided also that the legislative power of the several states shall not be restrained from prohibiting the importation or exportation of any species of goods or commodities whatsoever, provided also that all such duties as may be imposed shall be collected under the authority and accrue to the use of the state in which the same shall be payable. Another mouthful. So let me wrap it up and maybe you can help us translate this. And provided, lastly, that every act of Congress for the above purpose shall have the assent of nine states in Congress assembled of establishing rules for deciding in all cases that captures on land or water shall be legal, and in what manner prizes taken by land or naval forces in the service of the United States shall be divided for appropriated of granting letters of marque and reprisal in time of peace, appointing courts for the trial of piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and establishing courts for receiving and determining finally appeals in all cases of captures, provided that no member of Congress shall be appointed judge of any of the said courts. Okay, this is a mouthful. Maybe you can do some translation for
okay,
us.
Okay, so... One of the things that was occurring was the states, these individual states were already out there creating their own trade agreements. And it was actually, you know, making the Continental Congress kind of flap around in the wind where they became impotent.
Okay.
Where clearly they were supposed to control all the importation of goods. And what was ending up happening was these states would be creating these exclusive agreements where these goods would be coming in, where Congress would say, no, we're going to bring the goods in from here, not from there. Mm-hmm. And you got to remember that as we were heading into the Constitutional Convention, there was a huge divide where there were actually terms of people that were called Francophiles, right?
Okay.
And what was the term for the British? Anglophiles, okay. And Francophiles. And right. So, you know, when people were actually trying to promote trade and, you know, bringing in stuff from Britain, they were being accused of being an Anglophile. When the other, you know, groups and governments were saying, well, we want France, Francophiles. And so they were, America was dividing over the direction of how they wanted commerce to be managed at the state level. And the states were really becoming a big part of that problem, where Continental Congress should have actually been able to control the commerce coming in and from where they would come in from, which would be strategically to the best interest of the union, not necessarily to the best interest of a particular sector of the union, like what we, because we noticed that the northern states were kind of Francophiles. And it's kind of interesting that you would, not Francophiles, they were Anglophiles. It's kind of interesting how Massachusetts was the first and the one that suffered kind of the most from the British tyranny. They were one of the first kind of to go back to them.
Really?
Yes.
Go back to Britain?
Yes. So what I mean by that is they wanted protections in certain trades, like as we go through the cod fishery bounties, which is around the corner here. As we look at where you found, you know, the alliances, you would find that actually some of the southern states preferred, you know, some of the French, and then some of them didn't. So they were all basically creating their own regional preferences of who they wanted to deal with.
Right.
And one of the nice things about that is when you actually have, you know, a chaotic state, you can create a really good situation for yourself by creating an exclusivity, but it becomes problematic at that too. Because when you actually create an exclusive trade agreement, then, you know, you're no longer, you know, you don't have the economy of scale where you can create an exclusive agreement of the entire group. In other words, you're kind of pitching yourself against, and it never bodes well. That's not the best way of managing trade agreements. Having a centralized trade agreement, which is one of the reasons why they actually made it so that the federal government would manage all of the trade. Now, I'm here to tell you that when we've talked about this, and I've laid this out here, and I've kind of helped people understand that the federal government has been given this control over the strategic interest of commerce, the strategic interests of, you know, these very specifically commerce. And I'm going, they have proven that they actually don't do a good job. And the reason they don't do a good job is because the Senate is no longer representative of the states.
Correct.
And getting rid of the 17th Amendment and allowing the Senate to actually have this overall control would restore that regulating. So we have one more amendment for the Articles of Confederation before we get into this. So on Monday, we will actually cover that final amendment. So thank you for joining us, Paul. And folks, as I always say, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.